Hey, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks everyone for coming today. We're here to talk about DevOps and the promise of DevOps. I hear they may have been a little snafu with the build app saying this was a debugging session. So if any of you are here for that, if we launched the debugger, that would be a very bad thing in this session. So we're here to talk about the promise of what DevOps can offer. And the key thing is will it work for people in even really large organizations? Yesterday and today, you may have seen several demos of Visual Studio Team Services and gotten a feel for the feature set, or maybe you use it yourself. This session is less about the tools as it is about the journey that our team went through trying to adopt DevOps practices and all the lessons we learned as part of that. Some were good, some, let's say, were painful. So I don't think I have all the answers by any means. What I'm hoping that you get out of this session is by learning through our experience and how we're doing things, and that maybe you'll get a couple of hints or tidbits that'll work for you in your teams. So a little bit about me. My name's Lori Lampkin. I run the program management team for Visual Studio Team Services. I love the product. I get to work on something that we need every day to help us collaborate better and deliver value, and that's the product I work on, and that's how we like to run our team. So it's a great match. On a personal level, I like spending time with my husband and my twin boys. So they're 13, so I'm doing a lot of sitting on the sidelines of sporting events that they're participating in. And for myself, I like to spend some time doing Zumba and yoga, and maybe I'll be in the booth after this, so maybe you can convince me to demonstrate some arm balances or a headstand. No, I'm just kidding. And I brought with me today Brian Keller, who's also on the team services team, and I'll let you introduce yourself.
Sure. So I know a lot of you already because I spent most of the last decade running evangelism for Visual Studio Team Services and Team Foundation Server. And when Lori called me about 18 months ago and said we were spinning up a new team within her organization to help Microsoft adopt Visual Studio Team Services, it was a really great fit for me. I've got a toddler at home. I don't want to live on airplanes anymore. So I've been doing that for the last 18 months.
Great. Glad to have you with me. So what kind of scale are we talking about here? Team Services is adopted pretty widely by Microsoft. There's about 43,000 unique users of Team Services last month. They use all different elements of it, and it's growing over time. What we're looking at, growing pretty aggressively, really. The intent is that the team services tooling is the default tooling for the company to use for their DevOps workflows. So teams are just adopting as their businesses allow for it and as their needs on their engineering teams are ready for it. And specifically, we're in developer division. That's about 4,300 people. We all have adopted team services across the board for our DevOps workflows. But I'm going to talk today about the journey of the team services team ourselves. We're about 436 people, which makes up about 35 feature teams. And they're spread out all over the globe, from India to North Carolina to Redmond and lots of different places. So this is the team that said, you know, we need to go and embrace these new practices because we build tools for them, so we better really understand them deeply. But, you know, we had some real business needs as well that we thought DevOps could really help us with. We needed to deliver value to our customers more quickly, and we needed to increase our cycle time. And so the business needed it. The business needed us to do it. Our customers needed to see the value more, and the team itself really needed a way for them to get their hard work in customers' hands as quickly as possible. Because before, we're looking at what is a 2-year product cycle. So this is kind of how it worked. We had a little planning session that was in the gray. Then we did some coding, we did some testing and stabilizing. Released it to customers in beta form, did a little bit of feedback incorporation, and then stabilized again. Took about 2 years. And so you can see from an engineer perspective that I wrote something 2 years ago, and it still hasn't hit customers' hands. And from a customer perspective, it's like, you know, I go and I get this beta, and what are the chances that the features that we developed are just perfect? No, none. There's no chance. Like, we get feedback, it helps improve. We need that iterative process. But in this model, what we were doing is that we'd get the customer feedback, and we'd have to say, oh, okay, well, that's good. We should incorporate that, but we're really booked trying to get this 2 years' worth of work out into everyone's hands. So we'll address your feedback with the next improvement a couple years from now. That doesn't work at all. So this is kind of the problem and the space that we were in. We needed to work much faster. So the first change that we made was pretty obvious. Okay, let's just like shorten the timeline maybe. That seems like the right thing to do. Instead of 2 years, let's try for like 4 or 5 months. Let's embrace this agile thing, work in sprints. So we created 3-week sprints, and then we created a stabilization period. Because, you know, it was kind of scary. You know, we had these big, long stabilizations, so let's just make sure we insert that into our schedule. Seems okay. Seems like a reasonable approach. Let's see what happened. So we had team A. They went, they built some features, so that's kind of, and then they burned down their bugs and went into the next sprint, built some features, burned down their bugs, and they got to the stabilization period. They were ready to integrate and ready to do some deployment. Team B decided, hey, there's a stabilization period. Why do I have to fix any bugs? Like, I'm just going to work the way I always did. In fact, I'm motivated to get the maximum number of features and maximum stuff out to my customers, so I'm going to cram it all in there, and then I'm going to use the stabilization period to, you know, wind it down and get ready. Well, we have these two teams at totally different points in time, and what happened? Team A ended up fixing bugs for Team B's code base. It was not a good day, let's just say. So we knew we had to do something. And the thing is that the teams that are incurring the debt are the teams that need to be paying the debt down. So we did something radical for us. We got rid of the stabilization. Done. So now we're working in 3-week sprints, and there's no stabilization period. If a team accrues debt, then they have to take a sprint and burn down their debt. But it's just their team doing it. And if you don't accrue debt, you just get to keep delivering customer value every single sprint. And let me tell you, in the old way, you know, where we worked, having months and months of stabilization, it's not super fun. People want to work on the new features. So this created a nice balance and a self-fulfilling cycle where it rewarded kind of the behavior to deliver value but burn debt at the same time. And so now in 2 years, we can have lots of sprints, and the teams are working well. So that's great. A lot of learning, but we got there. Now we have a lot of teams. So the question is they're all operating independently, and they're working well, but how do we keep this all aligned? Because we do have a business, we have some goals, metrics, we have some scenarios, what we want people to drive to. We have a very integrated product. We do end-to-end workflows that we build. And so it's every feature team just can't operate independently. We have to be able to work together. So what we look at is a set of principles that, you know, this is just about how you run teams. You have to think through all of these things. How do we want to organize ourselves? What roles do we have? What cadence? How many teams? That sort of thing. And we had to really think about which one of these things are really important to be the same across the organization versus which things can be, teams can be free to do the way they want to. So I look at the things at the top as things that are really vital for the organization to stay aligned. For example, you know, if I'm an engineering lead on one team, and I have a UX person on another team who does engineering work, I don't know how to, if we have different titles for the same work, I don't know who to talk to collaborate with. Where's my peer and my counterpart? We need clear roles that are same across the teams. Or we need the same taxonomy. If I'm talking about scenarios or features, we should kind of be knowing what we're talking about here when we're working across teams. So those are things that are really hard to not be the same. We need to align on those. But there's a set of things that we look at, teams can work the way they want to work. We took a lot of inspiration from the book Drive by Daniel Pink, if you've heard of it. He talks a lot about, you know, how you can give teams autonomy and sense of purpose. And that really helps instill a positive and engaged working environment. I once had a set of poll results where people said, I got bad results on, hey, I can't, I feel free to change or try new things. Processes get in the way of me getting work done. You know, those are questions we ask our whole company, and I get results for my team. And they were really low. And that was one of the things early in my career when I saw that. I'm like, if I can allow teams to have more control over their work environment, be able to do retrospectives, to be able to make changes in how they work day to day, and yet still have alignment into the rest of what we're trying to do as a business, that's the ideal scenario. So that's the balance that we try to strike between alignment for the org and autonomy for the teams. So let's talk about the taxonomy that we use in team services ourselves. We start with some business goals and business metrics, and from there, we define a set of customer problems and the scenarios that we're going to go after. From the scenarios, they break down to features, stories, and tasks. But there's a level where I want to know, like, what do I want to get on stage and talk to people about that we're delivering? Are those features going to be ready for me? The dangerous thing would be for me to go and go look at all the people's task progress on their team. If they're rolling up stories and tasks into features, I'm getting a view of progress and a sense of alignment to what our goals are without having to understand if individual tasks that people are working on are actually, you know, on time or falling behind. Let's let me and my leadership team focus on the business and looking at the feature progress. And let's let the team choose how they want to manage their work, choose how they want to plan, choose how they want to work. If some people want to do pair programming, great. You know, if some people want to do Scrum or others Kanban, great. Let them do that as long as their stories and tasks roll up into our view of the business. Another common taxonomy we have across the team is bugs and LSIs. This helps us keep an eye on the debt for the bugs and health for live site incidents, is what we call LSIs, that make sure that teams aren't accruing debt through the course of their different sprints. So in the planning process, we look at planning those scenarios, defining that high-level strategy about once every 18 months, or we kind of revisit it once a year, but we look at an 18-month window. And the goal here is to set a North Star of where we're going. And we define some scenarios of where we want to be 18 months from now, but they're at a pretty high level. And I look at this as something that we can inspire the team with. So we don't want it to be crazy, like work that will take 10 years, and I'm presenting that to the team. That's really deflating for the team to feel like we keep talking about stuff we never can do. So it has to be kind of in a near-term window. But we don't do a bunch of costing to make sure all this can be done. I kind of put a 60% confidence rate. It's aspirational. That's what we hope to get done in this period. And then every 6 months, we do seasonal planning, where we look at a six-month window, we refresh the scenarios, and at this point, we really create some storyboards that show the customer value proposition of what we hope to deliver end-to-end in that period. So that's a little better. You know, at this point, we're talking about a shorter window, and so the confidence rate is, again, around 80%. There's been no scheduling, no planning done. It's just very much in the ballpark. Then we get to the real scheduling. This is when the teams go and say, all right, I know what the vision is and what the scenarios we're going after. What am I going to do in a quarter? We operate in 3-week sprints. So what we do is we say, for the next 9 weeks, what is your team planning on delivering? We hold something called feature chats. So the teams do their planning, and we hold something called feature chats. And that's kind of a unique thing that we do, I think. It's me and my peers and my direct reports, the people running all the feature teams. And we bring in all 35 of these teams, and they come in and they have about, 10 to 15 minutes to explain, here's what we're going to do in the next three sprints, here are the problems we're having and issues and stuff like that. We have that conversation. This is great because we don't have a lot of lost in translation, telephone game sort of things going on. I'm also not looking at reports and misreading things. Like, that's a nice thing to look at, but it's not the only source of truth. And I get to have a face-to-face conversation around course corrections that they can understand where I'm coming from. They can push back. I can understand what they're not getting to and be concerned, say maybe I need to load balance. And with all my directs in that meeting as well, they can kind of look at it and go, well, wait a minute, I need that for my scenario, and that team, they don't have it in the next quarter's level of work. So it helps us with our dependency management that we're doing. So it's more of a cultural practice in having this conversation and having course corrections be done in a way that people can align to what we're doing and through engaging them versus using a tool to just do that. And then we do 3 week, and that's got a higher level of confidence. At this point, we're just talking about three sprints. And then lastly, we do sprint planning. This is only a 3 week time frame, so the confidence level is pretty high. It's not 100%, but the teams do their backlog planning at this point. So we go into these 3 week sprints. They do their planning early in the sprint, and they send a mail saying what the sprint plan is. And at the end of the sprint, they send another mail saying what they accomplished. I put an example here of real mail that we sent the team. I have a couple of things I wanted to point out here. One is that it's two VS Cloud services all. That's the 436-person organization, all individual contributors, all leadership, everything. Yes, everyone gets some 40 emails for each, team every week. Every 3 weeks, excuse me, and that's a lot. But people, what it is, it's a level of transparency. I can know what every team's doing. I can know what just the teams I care about are doing, just the teams I depend on are doing. And in this mail, I see the goals that the team was after, and I see the user stories that they plan on completing. So people at a glance, especially in dependency relationships, can say, oh yeah, good, they're delivering what I thought I needed. And then when they're done, they send what they accomplished, and they send a demo video. I love the demo videos. I do ask them to keep them to only 3 minutes because I've got some 35 to watch. So that's a big investment, but it's so worth it. Because now do I not just see lists of work, I see the designs, I see the product coming together, and I ask people to talk about the customer value, the value proposition that they're putting forth with that work. It's a great way for me to provide design feedback and make sure that the problems as I understand them are the problems as the team understand them as well. So I'm going to have Brian come and show a bit of a demo here on how we work. I hear you're doing it with our live data, with our team at home.
This is our actual VSTS account, so hopefully nobody from marketing here is going to get upset if I disclose something accidentally. But this is our real account. And so what I thought I would show for these demos today are just some examples that reinforce the culture and the processes that Lori's been talking about. So you heard her talk about organizational alignment and team autonomy. So here I'm looking at one of the major teams within our organization. This happens to be the Agile team's dashboard. So my peer Aaron Bjork runs the PM team, reports to Lori, and this is the dashboard that they use to get on the same page. You'll notice here that we have very clear role definitions. So here you can see Valentina is the engineering lead for that team. Aaron is the PM lead. Over here you can see each of the six feature teams that roll up to that part of our scenarios. And you can see that our product owner is basically the combination of the PM for that feature team as well as the engineering lead for that feature team. So they jointly share the responsibility of product owner. And Lori showed that pyramid with the line in the middle. And so let me show you the Kanban board that actually represents that line in the middle, which is the set of features that this entire organization here is driving towards. We use a lot of Kanban. We love Kanban. It shows us a really clear flow of value out from a new idea that's over on the left-hand side out to something that's actually deployed and in production. And we also have a very clean and easy-to-use taxonomy that we use to enforce how we're actually going to communicate the status of these items. So if I take a look at this move work item feature, that's the feature name. Sandra is the PM for that feature. I can see she's on the blueprint team. I can see this happens to be an item off of user voice. It's always important to make sure that we're giving special attention to what you're telling us you want to see delivered. So we have a special tag to track user voice items. We really do pay attention to that. And then we also have a tag that indicates which sprint we think it's going to be deploying to. Now, Lori showed the various confidence intervals, so things that are on the right side of our board have a very high degree of confidence. Things that are off to the left side, we have less confidence in exactly when they'll ship. So here you'll see this is a quarter three feature. This one we think is going to ship sometime in H2, and then it's the PM or the product owner's job to really keep that up to date as it moves from left to right. If I take a look at another item here, this is the pick list work that we're doing for process customization. You'll also notice, we'll talk a little bit more about feature flags and how we flight features into production. You'll see that right here on the work item, I can tell that this feature has already been flighted to some of our early adopters. The other thing you can notice here is that we link directly to our specifications. And so that way, anyone across the leadership team that wants to see the spec for this feature can jump right to the specification. So it can be sometimes jarring for junior PMs when they start getting feedback from our CVP, Brian Harry, about, hey, why is that a drop-down as opposed to a text box or whatnot? But it really shows that the organization is very transparent, and we really care at that level of detail to make sure we're delivering high value. Now, that's organizational alignment. Lori also talked about how the individual teams, like the Blueprint team or the WITPI team, they can really practice the level of Agile that they want. And if they want to use Kanban or they want to use task boards, that's totally up to them. So if I take a look at one of these teams here, this is the Blueprint team. I can click into their Kanban board. And you'll notice that they've customized it with their own set of columns and swim lanes. And if I take a look at the Blueprint team, they've customized their own board. And that's something that you yourself can do within Visual Studio Team Services. You can individually customize those boards to fit your specific processes. If I pivot up, if I go back to the middle tier and I pivot back up to scenario, I'll just show you how we relate the features back to the top-level planning scenarios. I'll just turn on parents for our backlog. And now you can see that we've got this planning season, which is the H1 of 2016. And if I open that up, you can see these are all of our themes for H1 related to the Agile at Scale pillar. And then if I break that out, you can see all the features that are going to accrue to that. So it just makes it very easy for us to come together as a team. The one last thing I'll show you as part of this demo is the release notes process. If I go look at this board, I think I had... feature that deployed recently for providing Kanban shortcuts, you'll notice that once features deploy, if they are customer-facing features, we ask the PM to write the release notes for that feature. And that way, when we go to roll up our release notes, which if you use Visual Studio Team Services, hopefully you found our release notes under the News tab, and then click on the Features Timeline. Things at the top represent things that we're working on now, and then things at the bottom represent things that we've deployed. So there's the keyboard shortcuts for the Kanban board. If I open up those release notes, those came straight from the PM that worked on that feature. So again, just giving teams the autonomy to practice the way that they want while still ensuring that organizational alignment is a very important starting point as you start moving towards a DevOps workflow.
Great, thanks. So seems like everything's going great. After we got the cadence of, you know, how we want to work as an organization and roll up all the work, we still weren't actually doing our deployments very frequently. What was going on is that the deployments were really hard. And so it took us a long time to do the deployments. And there were a lot of issues with the deployments. And then they took months. And so we said, you know what? Let's not do it all the time because it's really hard. And it takes us a long time and it slows us down. So let's kind of space these out. Well, that doesn't fix itself. That just kind of perpetuates itself. And we're like, we're still not delivering as fast as we want. It took us to really change our thinking and say, you know, actually, Maybe the deployments are hard because of the payload that we're sending up to our deployment. And if we have a very small payload, there'll be less issues. And the issues that we do find will be easier to diagnose because the engineers had just wrote this code a couple of weeks ago, not a couple of months or 6 months ago. So things are fresh on their mind. So it was very counterintuitive to us at the beginning. You can call us, you know, you can say, duh, you know, but for us it was really hard to say, by doing something that is really difficult more frequently, that it'll get easier over time, and that we'll build a muscle that we keep using that'll help us be more effective, and then it won't be hard anymore. So that was our goal. We said, that's our new hypothesis, let's go try it out. So in Agile, the big thing in order to start making work happen in smaller chunks, the big thing is setting that cadence for the team, that 3-week cadence and no stabilization and all that, help drive Agile practices into the team. For DevOps and for continuous delivery, the big thing here was about accountability. Who's accountable for what's in production? In the past, we had the program management team, the development team, the testing team. And I put the operations team way off over there because they were kind of this afterthought that we talked to every once in a while. And we were like, this is just too many different people, things are going through. So we merged dev and test, and we brought operations in very close to our organization. And what this did is it enabled engineers to have end-to-end accountability. No longer are they waiting for a test team to catch up and to understand the feature in order to test it. No longer are they waiting for an operations team to, you know, do a bunch of work and, you know, just throw over things that the ops team will handle. Now the engineers are accountable for that end-to-end. They're accountable for the quality of the code in production. I know that most of you can't go back to work and your teams and go reorganize everybody. So I'm not really expecting that, but I think the concept of end-to-end accountability is the thing to focus on here. The org structure helped make that very clear, very fast for an abrupt change. But thinking about operations or thinking about testing as a separate organization requires handoffs and slows things down, and also requires the dev team, you know, to kind of just wash their hands and say, it's not my problem. So with that, we now have our feature teams, of which you talked about the WITPI team and you talked about the Blueprint team. Those are some examples of a program manager and the engineers. It's about 8 to 12 people. We try to keep them intact for that kind of North Star 12 to 18 month planning I talked about earlier. And they're the ones who have their own autonomous backlog, customizing their process, you know, saying how they want to work. We also did something radical and moved people from all their individual offices into team rooms. This is a picture of one of them. This is not an open space environment. This is a room that only fits that 15, 18 people size, and everybody in that room is part of that feature team. So what happens is the conversations, casual or whatever, apply to everybody that's working on that team. There's some context that's relevant. I can tell you a lot, I can probably talk for an hour about our transition to team rooms from offices on our team. There are a lot of people very worried about it. But in the end, we've seen a productivity lift from the increased collaboration and really a more fun and helpful atmosphere to work in day to day. So with this, with the change in accountability and the increased collaboration with the team, we can now do our sprints like we were before, but at the end of week 3, we don't just move on to the next sprint, we do the deployment. So we've got all of our teams working, now they are ready to deploy at the end of their sprint. That seems all good, but the problem is my own team might have their stuff in great shape, but we're trying to bring in all of the different teams together here. And, you know, putting it all together, we're gonna find a new set of issues. So how are we going to manage that better? It just seems like as soon as we solve one problem, we find another one, doesn't it? So the way we used to work was every team created their own branch. And so they'd work in the sprint, and they'd accrue, you know, a bunch of code that they've been writing, and they write some more code the third week, and now it's time for that integration period before we deploy. And it all needs to come together, all those different branches. And I call this merge debt, because now we have a lot of different things kind of all coming together, and we're like, how are we going to address all of those issues in the 1 week that we have? So what we saw was that deployment week getting longer and longer and longer as we're working through the issues. And then they affect the next sprint. And it becomes one of these things that, you know, now we're not delivering on that three-week cadence anymore. So the thing that we did here is we put everybody in one master branch. And so that was pretty aggressive because, you know, it's a pretty large team to do that with. At the same time, we moved to Git. Git helped a lot because we could have lightweight branching happen. And people can have topic branches, and branches is when you're done with the work, it just kind of goes away, yet I can clone the whole history of that master branch. And it really helps with tiny, continuous merging, which is great, you know, through the pull request workflow onto the master branch, but extremely lightweight when you're working on your local topic branches. That same tiny continuous merging is a lot like that deployment problem I was talking about earlier. Smaller updates, less issues. The issues you do find are easier to diagnose, and the code is fresh on your mind, so you can be more productive getting it. So you're going to show us how we do that.
Let's do it. All right, so this is actually a real-world example. About a week ago, I was working with one of our biggest internal customers, the Windows and Devices Group. They have about 20,000 people all working in the same VSTS account, so very, very big scale. And they had managed to pose themselves a little bit. They had about 4 million files under a Team Foundation version control repo that someone had done a bunch of renames on, and they needed to undo it. So long story short, this required an escalation to our team. And so I created what we call a DTS. It stands for Days to Solution, which is kind of a throwback from the days that it really did take us multiple days, you know, or weeks to actually deliver a solution. In this case, we should probably rename it to Hours to Solution or Minutes to Solution
minutes,
a year
seconds.
From now, maybe.
Yeah.
But the idea is that I created this, and it got routed over to the version control team, and they assigned it to what they call their DRI, their designated responsible individual, just a person who's on call for that week or for that sprint to handle any high priority issues. And so that happened to be a guy named Jenga, and Jenga picked this up, and we had a brief back and forth where we used the comments of this work item to talk about what was going on, and he communicated back to me what was happening so I could keep the customer informed. And then what's really great is on the right-hand side, you can see these are the individual commits and pull requests that he's able to commit and check back into master and flow through a pull review process. So if we take a look at one of these, I can see that Lori was talking about lightweight branches. He literally created a branch under his user namespace, and he called it extend timeout for delete workspace. I mean, very lightweight, so you can name these things whatever you want that makes sense because they're just temporary until you can get the change back into master. Once he was able to make that change himself, he kicked off what's called a pull request. And the pull request is basically your signal to the rest of the team that I think this change is ready for master. And so when he kicked off that pull request, a few things happened. In the back end, in VSTS, we have what are called branch policies. Branch policies allow you to define your quality gates for what happens when somebody wants to move from one branch over into a master branch or just an up-level branch. And so here you can see that we have some builds configured. I'll just call out that that says advanced because we actually have more advanced config done to this than the UI currently supports. You can do this yourself using the REST APIs, but basically we've added new features to the REST APIs that haven't yet lit up in the branch policy UI yet. So that's what you're looking at here. But basically we kick off a build, we run some tests, or we kick off multiple builds in this case, and then we also have a set of required reviewers. And so the required reviewers might be different for different branches. In this case, this particular review needed to happen with the engineering lead for the entire version control space. And so now if we go back to that pull request, I could in real time see what was happening. So for a while, the build was running. Eventually, the build was finished and it succeeded. And then Taylor down here got an email that said he needs to approve this because he's the M2 engineering lead for version control. So of course this was high priority, so he approved it for my customer, and then that turned around and created a hotfix for us that then started to go through release management, which I'll show you a little bit later. Now this whole process happens virtually. In the old days, we used to have a shiproom meeting that we would run once a day, and that meeting happened at about 10 o'clock in the morning. So you would see all these teams that would scramble to figure out what code they need to change and make sure their tests were all up to snuff and make sure that they could go defend their fix and make sure they said, this is worth a hot fix. It's got high customer impact, and I've already tested it, and I'm sure that it's not going to regress any other capabilities. And the problem was that, you know, these meetings, as you can imagine, stressed a lot of people out. I actually, a couple days ago, asked if anyone had a picture of Shiproom lying around, and they sent me back this. So that's a pretty apt representation. But the reality is that now these things can happen all day long, and they happen virtually. So here's an email that our release manager got for another hot fix. She can see that this fix is being discussed. It has the template, which is required for all of our hot fixes. These are the same questions we used to ask in the physical ship room that we're just asking as a part of the process of this pull request. And it just makes it a lot easier. It also means that if we miss ship room for that day, we don't have to wait until the next business day to get a hot fix out. We can do it in the evening, over the weekend. It just makes us a lot more agile as a team.
Great. So now when before we'd have this integration debt building and this deployment debt building over time, as well as even bug debt, and then the team's faced with this mountain and months to go burn that down, we're operating much more where integration issues and with the small merges and small commits and the more lightweight deployments are going out, that we can just continuously keep that quality and make sure that we're delivering a good customer experience on the service. Okay, as I said, you know, we solve one problem and now another problem comes around. So the problem now is, what features are all done in a sprint? Like, what are the chances that everything's going to get done exactly when you planned it to get done? There are features that take more than one sprint to get done. You know, there might be very long-standing features. But we had a process where everything was just going into production. So what that meant is that people then needed to not merge their changes into master and keep it siloed so that it wouldn't go into production. So all of that good work about small merges and small deployments just went away as we have teams kind of isolated as they're not ready. So the solution that we had to this is something that we call ourselves feature flags. And there's partners out there, LaunchDarkly is one of them, that goes and actually has a service that you can use yourself for this. But here's what it does. You have a set of features. Your developer goes off, you know, and they've created one code path. And they can enable that just for themselves. And then they can put that in production just for themselves, or just for their team, or just for a few select customers, or a lot of select customers. And we can just turn this on in production to get more and more accounts lit up and being able to see this feature. And so then over time, as we feel confident that this is ready, then we can go and turn the feature flag on for everybody and then get rid of the old code path. So what this does is it allows us to keep deploying incomplete features, and there's just no UX that customers can actually see them or execute them, while their own team can continue to stay in the master branch and make sure that they're not building any deployment debt as the feature gets of higher and higher quality or higher or more and more completeness. So that was huge for us. And we applied it not just to the feature flighting, but also to the way we do our deployments. So we have several different deployments, 10 different data centers we're in now, something like that, maybe more. I only put three of them here. We call them scale units. And we have a scale unit in San Antonio, and you can see that as scale unit 0. That's the scale unit that we ourselves are on, all of those 4,800 people that I talked about earlier. So what we do is through our deployments, we deploy to that first, that deployment unit first. And we can see if there are any issues, because it's immediately work impacting on a very large organization right away. And we're doing it during work hours, so we can see the issues, and we have the people right there who can fix the issues. So if that becomes successful, then we'll go start rolling out to scale unit 1 and scale unit 2 and scale unit 7 and throughout. And by that, we can make sure that we stage our deployments and address any issues and minimize any potential customer impact from the changes. So we got a lot of different releases going on, hot fixes, deployments and staging. And it can get pretty chaotic. So we're going to show you how we've managed that.
Great. Thanks, Lori. So as you might imagine, we use our own release management tool to deploy Visual Studio Team services. So they sometimes say the mark of a good compiler is one that compiles itself. And that's what we do with our DevOps tools. And so here you're looking at our release management dashboard for all of VSTS. You'll see that there's quite a few release definitions on the left-hand side. Some of these are the different subservices of VSTS. Some of these are dev and test environments. As an individual developer, I can spin up my own instance of VSTS. And because we use configuration as code and because we build on top of Azure and we get the elastic scalability that it offers, it's very easy for us to spin those up on demand. You'll also notice here these different colors for the different environments. So we have different deployment rings. So our own deployment instance of VSTS, the one that I'm running from now, is the very first ring that we deploy to. So if we're going to break anybody, we want to break ourselves first. And so we call that ring 0. And then some of our deployments will actually try to go out and service all of the different rings. Occasionally, you'll see that we hit these blocks along the way. Sometimes we can't get exclusive locks on accounts, and we have to go investigate that. So sometimes there's a bit of trial and error with the deployment process. But this tool gives us very clear traceability into exactly what's going on so we can go troubleshoot that. If I take a look at the one that deploys our daily hotfixes, you'll see this one called TFS prod update. And if I go take a look at this release definition, it's very simple. When we kick off a release, we can decide if it's going to go to just ring 0 or just ring 3 or all 4 of the releases. You'll notice that before something actually starts this release chain, there's a required approver. So that's a fairly high-ranking engineer on our team that just does a human check to make sure that we've kind of ticked all the boxes before we push something out into production. And if we go back to the DTS that I was talking about earlier, I can actually find that directly in this review. So that happened to be an M90 fix hotfix that was deployed to ring 3. So if I take a look at this particular release, I was literally refreshing this page as Django was making the change and pushing it out through the release pipeline. And then as soon as this lit up green, I was able to go back to my customer and let them know that this was deployed and they could go try to delete those 4 million files that they had locked for themselves. So it just gives us really good traceability. So the one distinction that I wanted to clarify, because a lot of people ask, is we talked about feature flags and we also talked about scale units. So when we're deploying to the scale units, what we're deploying out there are the binary updates as well as any database schema changes that we need to make across those individual scale units. The feature flags, think of those kind of like the Windows registry. The binaries are already there, but the feature flag tells the code during execution time whether or not for this particular customer it should try to execute this code path. So I thought I'd show you just a quick demo of how we do that. I have my own test account here. And if you've used our new process customization experience with VSTS, hopefully this looks familiar. I can just come up and say that I'm going to add a new field to my bug, and I can give it a name. And right now, we're working on growing the list of controls that we support. And so you can see here that I don't yet have pick lists enabled in my account. But I'd like to try out that feature. I know that it's available to early adopters, so the binaries have been deployed. So in order to actually feature flag that for my account, this is a tool that our entire team has access to. It's very easy. I can just come in and specify TFS. And that's the name of the feature flag. And I'll specify the name of the account, and I'll just display the current status, which says that, says that it's currently off. And turning it on, I can just check on, submit. And now if I come back to my account and refresh this page, you'll notice that it's instant. And so we turn these on and off all day long. I mean, if we decide that there's the feature right there, so it's already picked up for my account. If we decide, thank you. After the talk, just $5 and I'll enable your account too. But really, this gives us a lot of flexibility. In fact, for that same customer, the Windows and Devices group, we turned on Move Work Item a couple of weeks ago. We realized it was introducing some problems because, again, they have massive scale. So we went in, we turned it off, nobody even noticed. We were able to quickly test there and then turn the feature off and make sure that we were delivering a high-quality experience before we announced it to people. Now, we've mentioned Launch Darkly a couple of times. We had to go build this whole feature flag infrastructure for ourselves, but we now have a great partner out in the marketplace. So you can just browse the marketplace. We have a lot of great partners out there. You'll notice that Launch Darkly is right here. And if you wanted to install this into your VSTS account, you could do that in a matter of minutes, and you could get started right away with using feature flags within your own service.
Great. So we were really excited about this because now we have this ability to test out our features with smaller sets of customers and really reduce the exposure risk. So with all of this flighting, now we have this opportunity not just to do it about quality or completeness of the feature, but we can do this in design as well. So we have the team, we want to be very data-driven with our approach here. We'd like to think about what is the hypothesis that I have. What are the metrics that hypothesis means? What is the experiment that I'm going to run? And then what is the learning, and how do I expect those metrics to change? I'll give you an example of that. Here it is. So when you create, this is our account creation experience in September last year when we were still called Visual Studio Online. And it was a two-step process. On the first step, which is the screen behind it, you created, your name, your email, you added, what country you're in so we could get you in the right scale unit, your account name, and you clicked on Create Account. And then you were popped up with this second screen that says Create Your First Team Project. And then you had to fill out the name of the project and the process template and whether you wanted Team Foundation Version Control or Git. And then we had a bunch of text trying to help you with that. And the existing experience baseline had a 30% conversion of people who started this process getting all the way through the end and actually creating their first team project. So we're like, wow, that's a lot of people who are kind of stopped somewhere in the middle here. I don't know why people would want to create an account and then give up on creating a project. So we had a hypothesis. And our hypothesis was that we could merge these two experiences into one and provide a unified account creation that also creates a team project by default, which now you can rename, so that makes that easier. And then we smart default your version control and your process template. That's more in the advanced settings. So what we did is we did A/B testing and turned that on through feature flags to a certain set of experiences. And then to 50%, and then as we saw good results, we were able to increase it. So now this is our new default experience where we saw a conversion of people completing, starting this dialogue, a lift of almost 20% from that initial 36. So we still have a ways to go, but that's kind of the approach that we're taking to make sure we're very data-driven in the changes that we make and as we experiment with this. Now, let's see. That's great, but people get so excited about, wow, I can deliver this stuff as experiments to customers. So let's just throw everything out there and let's just get customer feedback and let's iterate on it with our customers in the wild. And that's great. That sounds wonderful. Now the problem I'm faced with is people not doing due diligence in their design. So it's like we're getting feedback that we kind of knew. We could have figured that out. And the engineering rework costs are starting to go up a little bit. So I am now facing a problem of how do I, just like before when I said, gosh, if I can create a process that incents the right behavior in people, where naturally I want to deliver value to customers, and so boy, if I keep my debt down, I can do that more and work on more fun things. That's a very virtuous cycle. How to do it for experimentation, I'm still a little bit stumped at that, because it's a judgment of when a design is good enough to be able to begin that experiment and reduce the engineering rework costs. So if any of you have any tips on that, I'll be in the booth after this. I would love to hear that. That's the current problem I'm wrestling with today. So we have a lot going on in production. You saw all of those different releases. They're happening real-time, hot fixes and updates and various levels of change. First and foremost is the health of the experience that people have with team services. We have what we call a live site culture, which means that everything, nothing else is more important than the health of the service. So this is a picture of our break room in North Carolina. You can see our health dashboards are just everywhere for people to keep that top of mind to reinforce our culture. Here is an example of our dashboard. This is showing our performance and our availability and memory usage and a bunch of different things. And we go crazy with this. We collect a ton of data. I mean, we collect activity logging and tracing, and we do perf counters, and we collect 60 gigabytes of this a day on what we're doing with the service. So with all that data, clearly we can't just sit there and just look at the charts and try to find the anomalies of what's going on. We have to create models that help us understand when things deviate from the norm and that we might have an issue. So here's an example of a learning that we went through around monitoring availability. We started out with outside-in synthetic tests. We had a test account. We hammered it. We tried to see if the customer experience was good. We quickly abandoned that approach since it just wasn't indicative of all of the accounts. The test account, wasn't a good representation of all of the accounts. So then we went ahead and said, let's aggregate command health across the whole service into one core metric there. And so this is the diagram that I have here now. Pay attention to the black lines here. The dashed line is the command health aggregate metric. And we had a live site incident on September 25th. And that metric did not collect, did not indicate that there was a problem on the service at all. It worked really well when we didn't have a ton of accounts or a ton of large accounts like Windows with how many people?
20,000.
20,000. Their health of their account just drowned out the health of the really small accounts. So an account with 5 users or something could be having a really bad experience, and we don't know about it. So then we went to phase 3, which is we went to failed or slow user minutes per account. So it normalized the data. And you can see that in this black line here, where you can see the dip in availability that was pretty significant and stretched over a period of time of a couple of hours there. Now we can see, even for small accounts, that they have a voice in this process and we have a better way of monitoring. So it's definitely a learning process. So we get our models right. Then we want to make sure that people can act on them immediately. So that brings us to alerting. We started in a terrible state with alerting. We had over 1,000 alerts firing a week. It was horrible. It's just distracting and annoying and noise to the developers. They're just then they go try to work on them. They'd find a bunch of redundant alerts. They would find alerts that weren't actionable. And so it was just ignore the whole thing. Well, what's the point of having any alerts, really? So we decided now is the time to really take a hard look and make our alerts really instill a sense of urgency on the team. So we went through and triaged all of these alerts that came through, and we got rid of all of the ones that weren't actionable. We just stopped firing them. That's what we were going to do about them anyway. We went and took the ones that were redundant and tried to create things like a health model to be able to bring them together and to be able to diagnose which components were firing these different alerts, and so that we could better align redundant alerts into one notification. So we went from 928 alerts per week to 22. That was huge. And those alerts were actionable. So actionable that we could go and say, see all these alerts on the red stream here? They're all coming from that APM component. I know who the designated response engineer is for that component. And so we can go and we can actually use our auto dialer to call that person and tell them there's an alert. So then that it leads to a great sense of urgency. Immediate detection, alert, immediate response, and they're on the issue. And this is another one of those processes that is self-fulfilling or very virtuous in nature, because, boy, if you start getting unactionable alerts and you're getting called, that's really annoying. So that you're going to get rid of those alerts or you're going to fix those alerts and you're going to keep the whole alerting system very healthy throughout. So then when we do have issues, we track them in live site incidents. This is an example of one. We collect a lot of data for it. The key here when the live site incident is going on is mitigating it so that the user experience is back to a good state. And then afterwards, we do a root cause analysis to figure out what happened. That's usually a meeting with key leadership and all the engineers that were on the call debugging the issue. From there, there's a set of remediation items that people work on, and those things go back into the product team backlogs. And so that gets incorporated into the future sprint plans to make sure that that these issues don't happen again. When a live site issue happens, the sprint is interrupted. You know, people who need to work on the live site stop working on any feature work or anything else that was planned to this sprint for that sprint. A lot of teams use the new expedite lane in our Kanban boards, creating a new swim lane at the top to show those live site incidents and their remediation steps progressing in their sprint backlogs. Once we're through that, we also have a monthly business review. In that review, we look at a lot of our metrics. And this is one of the screens in that review, the one focused mainly on service availability and health. There's a lot of data here. You can see the red and green, and that's the overall average availability in 2015. Our goal is 4.9, so anything in red is stuff that where we didn't quite meet our SLA. And we go through and we diagnose, you know, what were the issues that caused that, et cetera. Now, what we try to optimize for is time to detect and time to mitigate. That is about the user experience. Like, we could, while we try to remediate the issues and make sure that they won't happen again, production is unpredictable and things will go wrong. And if you do not have the time to detect and time to mitigate in a really good rhythm, you know, that is the thing to focus on. It's most about what the customer is experiencing. And it's also important that we balance that and don't become too risk adverse because of that whole conversation I was having earlier about our deployments are light and easy to make. And so if there are issues, we can redeploy, not roll back. That's a really complicated problem, but we can redeploy, we can deploy hot fixes. All of this can keep things going forward, and we're not accruing that, getting so risk adverse that we're accruing that deployment debt again. You know, we want to keep deploying to make that smooth. So the key metrics for us are detect and mitigate. And throughout the live site, experience, we try, you know, we're very, very transparent with all of our customers on what's going on. We're on Twitter, we have our team services blog, we talk about the status of the service, where we are, and then afterwards when we have a root cause analysis for large incidents, Brian Harry, my boss, will post it on his blog. He'll talk about all the things we learned from it, all the changes we're making to our processes to make sure things don't happen again. But we do use our services blog to talk about not only the state of where things are, but what happened and what we learned. So what I've shown you today is our journey adopting a lot of DevOps practices from continuous delivery and monitoring and experimentation and agile planning and debt management. But it's really been, for me, about the people, about the impact we're able to have on all of our customers, to be able to get more value and us to be more connected and responsive to your ideas and feedback. And also about the people on the team, where they can see a short duration between when they write the code and when customers get to use it. And that just makes everyone a heck of a lot happier. So I know all of you have your own stories, and there are some people here who would love to hear them. We'd love to learn about them. There's a Share Your Story booth in the Visual Studio area, and if you have a chance to stop by and tell about what you've tried to do with DevOps, we'd love to hear about it and learn from it. Also, there's a site here, aka MS Dev to Dev. You can register there if you don't have time here. We're just looking to hear about customers' experiences with DevOps so we can all learn from each other. So thank you very much. Thank you.